7-year-old Jacob has severe autism. He barely spoke and was so withdrawn that the first time he hit a drum, his father was so overwhelmed that he broke down and cried. After 2 years of music therapy, Jacob is singing entire songs, playing instruments, and laughing joyfully for a full hour. His ability to interact has improved so much that his special ed teachers are awed and amazed. They didn't know how to reach him. HVCATS.org knows that music can provide healing in some very special ways. Their licensed and certified therapists provide creative arts therapy services at their Hudson Valley studio, as well as outreach programs in your home, in schools, and facilities. At HVCATS, miracles happen every day. If you'd like to learn about bringing creative arts therapies to your home or facility, you can visit HVCATS.org or reach them by phone at 845-514-8669. That's 845-514-8669. Well, hey there, my friends. You're tuned in to Anything Goes. I'm Lise Avery, mixing jazz, standards, and classic pop in a way you can't find too many places these days. And since we're all kind of a community with our musical tastes in common, I hope that you'll take a moment to like Anything Goes Radio on Facebook and visit me on my personal Lise Avery page, too. Or next time you visit the AnythingGoesRadio.com website, sign up for my newsletter so I can drop you a line now and again and keep you apprised of cool giveaways and interesting interviews. Meanwhile, I promised you part of my nearly 3-hour interview with Frank Sinatra Jr. Before I begin, I'd like to tell you a little bit about how this interview came about. In November 2013, I scheduled an interview with Frank Sinatra Jr. in conjunction with a performance of his here in the New York Metro. When I scheduled that interview, I assumed that I'd have the privilege of 15 minutes on the telephone with Mr. Sinatra, and that would be that. But that isn't what happened. What did happen was that Frank stayed on the air with me for nearly 45 minutes, and even that is not as surprising as what happened next. We concluded the interview, and I expected to go back to my radio program, but instead, I stayed on the phone with Frank for quite some time. I'm sure the audience of my live New York program must have wondered where I got to, but Frank and I stayed on the phone for quite some time talking about everything from radio to the Marx Brothers. Next, Mr. Sinatra invited me to the rehearsal he'd be having for his upcoming show, and let me just tell you that having the privilege of being in attendance while a great musical master like Frank Sinatra Jr. is at work is an experience as amazing as you'd imagine it to be. If we're friends on Facebook, then you've already seen many pictures of me and Frank hanging out at various times. During the time I had with Frank, I learned a lot about the Sinatra family and Frank Sinatra Jr. He was a truly remarkable musician, an accomplished performer, incredibly intelligent and knowledgeable, and more important than any of that, was a genuinely kind and caring human being. And that's how I ended up with the privilege of recording an interview with him in his hotel suite for nearly 3 hours. This interview is, to my knowledge, the most comprehensive interview Mr. Sinatra allowed during his lifetime. And I have to be honest with you, almost everything Frank shared is terrific. So let's begin, ladies and gentlemen, hearing about the folks who lived in the neighborhood where Frankie grew up, beginning with Mr. Walt Disney. Walt Disney lived across the street from you when you were a kid?
When I was a little boy, Mr. Disney lived one house down across the street.
Uh-huh. And he had a model train?
Well, he had a train that was the size of a couch. And the tracks had a gauge of a foot wide or so, 18 inches wide, and you could actually ride in this train.
Uh-huh.
And it was a real bona fide steam engine, an old style, I think it was an 032 locomotive.
Mm-hmm.
And this was Mr. Disney's passion. And one of my best memories, Lise, in my young life is that every morning I would wait for the school bus with my lunch pail and my books. I was 10, 11, whatever it was. And I'd be waiting on the curb for the school bus, and out of the driveway, just a few feet north of where I was standing, Mr. Disney would leave his driveway, and he would stop and he would talk to me.
Hmm.
I used to say, "Good morning, Mr. Disney." He said, "Hello, Frankie," and I would talk to him. And it never occurred to me until years later, he would always want to talk to me more on Thursday. Because beginning in 1954, on Wednesday night, Walt Disney's first appearance on television began. The show was called Disneyland, named after an amusement park that he and his companies were building and getting ready to debut.
Uh-huh.
And the Disneyland TV show was on Wednesday night at 7:30. And that was my TV show I had to watch. And every Thursday morning, he would talk to me more and more. And I figured years later, obviously, I was his audience. A 10-year-old boy, 11-year-old boy. And like every kid in America, Lise, in the end of 1954, the beginning of 1955, I would be wearing a coonskin cap. Because he had debuted a sequence of television programs made about an obscure American folk hero named Davy Crockett. And the first morning he drove by and saw me in my coonskin cap, he laughed and waved at me and just drove away. Every little boy and little girl in America wanted a coonskin cap. And he was very, very nice to me, Mr. Disney was. Mr. Disney and the people he called the Nine Old Men, the people who had started with him, some of them in 1928, 29. What were their names? Wolfgang Ratherman, Perse Pierce, Ollie Johnston, Ub Iwerks, Winston Hibbler, Ward Kimball. The people, I don't remember the other men's names, it's a shame too, but the Nine Old Men that Disney called them, they had been with him from the beginning. And you have no idea, Lise, I mean, talk about a leap of faith here, I think they referred to it. They got ready to make, not an animated cartoon, they'd been doing that for over a decade. They got ready to make an animated feature. And they ran out of money. Walt Disney had no backing. He had no distribution. The early films were distributed by RKO. If you see a Disney project today, after the 50s, the beginning, you'll see a screen title, distributed by Buena Vista. All right, that's the Disney distribution machine. RKO wouldn't give them any more money, and they were making this animated feature, The Nine Old Men. They second mortgaged their homes, as did Mr. Disney. They borrowed money from everyone. And all of a sudden, here comes Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, and it's 1937. And in Los Angeles, and there's an area in the Wilshire District called the Carthay District. There's a museum, several meeting places and whatnot. And there used to be the great Carthay Circle Theater, where Around the World in 80 Days debuted in 1958, 56, whenever it was, where Cinerama debuted when that hit. And the most special pictures were at the Carthay Circle for their debut, including Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. And it was a black tie affair. You look in the history books about Walt Disney and you see Mr. and Mrs. Hollywood, Clark Gable and Carol Lombard and all these people, Charles Laughton and Elsa Lanchester, all formally dressed to go to see this new movie.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the critics wrote in the newspapers after this personal screening, just for the industry, "The public is never going to accept Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs because it is going to upset them physically looking at all that color for an hour and a half."
Frank Sinatra Jr. painting a vivid portrait for us of what it was like to attend the premiere of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs back in 1938. And I want you guys to know that when Frank began to list the Nine Old Men, as he called them, the animators who worked with Walt Disney in the beginning, Frank had no idea that I was going to ask him that question. His memory for detail was just that good, and he just named them all. But right now, let's don our best formal wear and travel back to the Carthay Circle Theater in Hollywood, and imagine we're in the theater with Clark Gable and Carol Lombard and Charles Laughton and Elsa Lancaster to see the debut of Snow White.
While you were
Those are some pretty high notes. A couple of wonderful tracks from the original motion picture soundtrack of Walt Disney's Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. And you're tuned into Anything Goes on this great station. And if you've just joined us, well, first of all, welcome. And thanks so much for tuning in. I'm Lise Avery, and the name of this mix of jazz, standards, classic pop, and interviews is Anything Goes. And we've come up to a break right now. But I hope you can stick around, because we've got more great stuff coming at you. On the other side, we'll be hearing something more from my interview with Frank Sinatra Jr., this time about why Bing Crosby's sons used to hang out at the Sinatra home. Right now, let's travel up to the break with an appropriately themed ditty from the Seven Dwarfs.
Hi, everybody. This is Frank Sinatra Jr. saying you're listening to Anything Goes with Lise Avery, leader of radio and her own way of life.
No trick to get rich quick.
If you dig, dig, dig with a shovel or a pick.
In a mine,
in a mine,
in a mine,
in a mine,
where a million diamonds shine.
We dig, 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 dig from early on till night.
We dig, 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 dig up everything in sight.
We dig up diamonds by the score.
A thousand rubies sometimes born,
but we don't know what we dig them for.
We dig, 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 dig.
I hope, I hope, I hope, I hope, it's home from work we go.